down shortly here, and H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Greetings! It is Saturday, the 25th of May in the glorious future year of 2024. And the first thing I have for you today is to let you know that I think I am actually happy with Blast Number 1. I think I'm ready to release this to the general public. So you can go to blast.man-and-atom.info, or if you prefer, Atomic Blast, ATOMICBLA.ST. That's a Sao Tome Principe domain name, the former Portuguese colony of St. Thomas and Prince Islands in the Gulf of Guinea, if you're interested. You can read the extensive notes there, as well as downloading both a version intended for reading on the screen and a version intended for printing, and there are also instructions for obtaining a printed copy from me, which I will summarize as follows. Write to Blast, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. And make it clear somehow, you know, you can send me a postcard or a letter, make it clear that you want a printed copy of Blast, and I will send you one. You need enclose no money, although I also always appreciate money. If you would like more than one copy, please enclose $1 or rough equivalent in your local currency per additional copy you want. In other words, I'm happy to give you the first one free, but to defray the costs of postage and printing and so on, I would ask for something for additional copies. So, you know, again, a US dollar, a Canadian dollar, a British pound, 100 yen, a euro, a Swiss franc, whatever. US dollars are the ones I can most immediately spend, but both euros and pounds and probably Swiss francs are ones that I will be needing in the near future, and Canadian dollars I can always make good use of. But yes, and equally, you can go to paypal.me/PrometheusLives, and in that case, since PayPal deducts a fee, etc., etc., I would ask you to send $1 per copy requested. Again, you just have to make sure that I know that you're asking for a printed copy of Blast, and that I know what your mailing address is so that when I send it to you, it will actually reach you. Anyway, so that's the long and short of it. Again, you go to the page there and click through the link to issue number 1, and there will be very extensive notes. In fact, I'm continually adding to them. The idea is to basically show you the thought process behind the thing I've written, because it's a fairly short little booklet, and it comes from distilling down literally hundreds of books worth of things that I've read, right? And then, of course, adding my own thoughts to that. So basically every page there are 3 or 4 things I could put an extensive note on, but no one would actually want to read that, so I have to limit myself somewhat. But you've got paragraph after paragraph of explanations and citations so that you can track down the numbers and so forth that I'm using. And I'm Well, obviously, that's not complete yet. I'm continually adding to it, as I said. Let's see. Next point, which is really what I meant to lead with, but the blast news is more important. This comes to you by courtesy, I'm afraid, of the U.S. Bureau of Customs and Border Protection, because when I was coming back to the U.S. earlier in the month, I was in the arrivals hall at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, where there were big signs that said, "No photography! No photography permitted! No! Don't take pictures while you're here!" You know, signs of the kind that imply that if you violate this terms on the sign, you will have a bad time. Signs of the sort that imply that they are enforced by men with guns. Although, the interesting thing for me, as far as CBP is concerned, is that the people doing the actual crowd wrangling all gave the strong impression of being freshly arrived in the U.S., and I had to wonder, is this some kind of work release? You know, are these people on the outside the customs barrier side of the line because they're not actually permitted into the U.S., that they snuck in and got caught and they've been deported to the airport arrivals hall where they have to work off right before they'll be permitted back? Is that how this works? CBP is such a bizarre organization that it wouldn't completely surprise me. But the thing is, right under, or and, you know, just next to the signs that say, "No photography permitted," there were signs saying, "Follow us on Instagram!" For those of you who don't know, I would be lucky if I didn't know, Instagram is an internet social media platform that is used for hosting photographs and short videos. Exactly what they want you to not be doing while you're in line. So the thing is, they say, "Follow us on Instagram." You get out your smartphone, you go to the photo and video sharing site where the whole purpose of it is to do the thing that they're explicitly telling you you're not permitted to do. It boggles my mind why anyone would want to follow USCPB on Instagram, what kind of content they could conceivably have which would be worth following. But it's also this incredible contradiction. It leaves my eyes just rolling around in my head like marbles. And it brings up something which notorious American no-goodnik Donald Trump said the other day. He actually said something cogent. Don't worry, I'm sure he'll recover soon. He said, "If you ban TikTok, it only makes Zuckerberg more powerful." And again, I have to explain, this is not my normal bailiwick, but I have to explain. Mark Zuckerberg is the owner of Instagram, and TikTok is another website where people share short videos. And he's right, right? You get rid of TikTok, people will probably go to Instagram. But this made me think about something else, because the thing is, Mark Zuckerberg controls two major internet social media platforms, Instagram and Facebook, and as far as I'm aware, they're not interoperable. And this is really interesting to me, because internet social media platforms, there's what's known as a network effect. In other words, you're on there because all your friends are on there. I'm not. I'm on SDF. Some of my friends are on SDF too, which is cool. Hi, Kuma. But here's the deal. They want you on there, and they don't want you to go anywhere else. So they have what some people call the walled garden effect. Now, this is what's really interesting to me, because if you think about it, when we go back to the early days of television, the FCC was not going to approve a television which would pick up only one channel, only one network. The FCC was not going to approve RCA, for example, the parent company of NBC in those days, not going to approve RCA selling a television set which would only pick up NBC broadcasts. Right. They weren't going to approve GE or somebody selling a television set which would only pick up CBS or ABC broadcasts. No, the FCC demanded that all television receivers that were sold be able to receive a wide range of channels, which the FCC then proceeded to grant broadcasting licenses on, not only to the major network stations, but also to independent stations. This is different, by the way, from some European countries where there was a push-button selector on the television, and the television installer had to tune each of those push buttons to an approved transmitter frequency. So you had a push button for BBC One, and if there was BBC Two, you had a push button for that too. If not, you just had a television with no selector control, because there was only BBC One. That was the only television channel there was, and a technician had to set it to receive that channel. Anyway, what am I talking about? Well, I just keep thinking about this problem of network effects. You know, I had a Facebook account for years, which I used mainly to communicate with a relatively small number of people who were on there. And then Facebook stopped working for me, and I stopped using it, and I decided I was better off without it, because, like most internet social media, my impression was that it was intended to cause mental illness. It's intended to cause hyper-focus. It's supposed to make you pay attention to all the time, what they call FOMO, fear of missing out. You want to pay attention to it all the time. You want to turn all your attention toward it. You want to get emotionally invested in what's going on there, simply because that makes life better for their advertisers. You see more ads when you're looking at the platform more, and the more emotionally riled up you are, the more weight you attach to the things you encounter when you're on the platform, including the advertisements, and the more likely, or the more valuable, in the opinion of the advertisers at least, those advertisements are. The idea is to turn off your brain, short-circuit your higher mental functions by getting you emotionally riled up and showing you lots and lots of pictures, lots and lots of short videos, lots of things that are intended to distract you, to occupy your attention, to leave you in a discombobulated state, where you can't do much other than respond to simple suggestions. It's a little bit like hypnosis. Anyway, so my opinion of internet social media is that it's unhealthy and that it's also a dangerous business model. And that's the thing, I think, because of this network effect, right? They don't want you leaving, and so there's no interoperability even between platforms that are owned by the same people. Because if you could go somewhere else and take your list of friends with you, that would be death for their business model. You know, in the end, people are excited about TikTok because, you know, it's to an extent controlled by the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. But the fact is, it's not really any different from any of the American-owned social media platforms as far as what it does to people or how it does it. And that's the thing, that if you ban TikTok, it only says, okay, well, people are going to go over to Instagram or some similar platform, right? It only makes Zuckerberg stronger. It doesn't weaken the access of the Chinese Communist Party to sensitive information about Americans because, as I've said before, they can simply go to the same data brokers that all the advertisers use, and they can buy that information in the open market. You know, Instagram and Google and all the other people who are trying to aggregate information about you, what you like, what you don't like, when you're at home, when you're not at home, so people can break into your house, what model of car you drive, and so on. All of these different aggregators, they sell that data. They make it readily available, and there's certainly nothing stopping the Chinese Communist Party from buying it. They've got the money. Buying it through intermediaries or middlemen, perhaps, to make it a little less obvious what they're doing. Anyway, but again, I try not to talk about this kind of thing, but it's not my bailiwick. What is my bailiwick? I don't know. But it's not computers. Right, everybody's talking about computers, everybody's talking about AI and cryptocurrency and this and that and the other thing, and I mostly don't talk about it. So that was about, you know, that was my 5 minutes or 10 minutes in a month that I talk about that on this show. What am I really here to talk about? Well, let's see. Of course, as you know, the Wall Street Journal attracts my attention every now and then, and there was a great example a couple of weeks back. You know, the Wall Street Journal is full of editorials and other kinds of content extolling the virtues of the free market. Right up until the point where a CEO, for example, gets accused of collusion to fix prices. And then they publish a long, elaborate piece which gives you a laundry list of all the reasons why market oriented decision making doesn't work so great. For example, when you have an industry such as the oil industry, or say the nuclear industry, the electric power industry, where you have to make large investments where the investments don't actually start making money for several years after you start putting money into them, right? The plant has to come online and start producing something, right? And then its payback period is some years past that, and the investment itself, right, the capital plant, is liable to last some years past the point at which it's paid off, right? You know, if you want to buy a nuclear power plant, you know, a gigawatt-scale nuclear power plant, it's, even under the best of conditions, it's going to take 4 to 5 years between when you sign the project and when the project actually begins delivering electricity to the grid. And then it's probably a 20-year payback period, right? You've financial, you know, the financials are penciled out for 20-year bonds or what have you, and then it probably lasts 40 years beyond that. And so market conditions right at this moment are not a particularly good gauge for what you should be doing. You have to use judgment and insight, familiarity with the industry, and of course these are the things that the high-frequency traders and the hedge fund managers and the business school executives, they don't have, they don't want, and they don't value. Your decisions are being made on a basis that even the editorialists of the Wall Street Journal will admit are not the correct bases for making judgments. And so it's not surprising, the things that we see happening. Anyway, that's something that I just thought I would bring to your attention a little bit. You know, that they're, it's really so transparent that the Wall Street Journal, for all they talk about free market economics and all that kind of thing, really they, what they print, what they say, is whatever the ruling classes, I hate to say that, but the ruling classes want them to say, right? It's, as I've said repeatedly, economists fill the same function in modern society that soothsayers filled in the classical age. They exist to provide the appearance of divine sanction for the decisions that are being made by the people in power. That's about it. And so you can bet that the moment it is convenient for the people in power, the owner class, right, the billionaires who control things like hedge funds, which in turn control things like who has a job, the moment it's convenient for them to abandon the free market ideology, the Wall Street Journal obligingly walks it back, obligingly backs away from the free market and tells you all about all the things that are wrong with it and why we should embrace the backroom deals made by our shadowy overlords. To do things like buy out a popular restaurant chain, sell all of the real estate, in other words, the buildings and the land and the parking lots of the restaurant chain, to a different organization owned by the same proprietors, and thus making the restaurants pay rent, right, where previously they didn't, and then to sell that restaurant chain onward to another group of businessmen. In particular, let's say, if it's a seafood restaurant, a group of businessmen who control about a quarter of the global trade in shrimp, and then suddenly the big menu item at the restaurant chain is shrimp. And then later you hear, oh, they're going bankrupt. Why, it must be because they've been selling this shrimp so cheaply. And it's like, the restaurant, who have they been buying the shrimp from? Well, the owners of the company, right, who could have set any price on that shrimp that they wanted to. And so if they set the price higher than what the restaurants can pay, then clearly it's because they wanted the restaurants to go out of business for some reason. That's how these things work. Now, but I have something that I think is kind of interesting here. Remember I mentioned Japanese yen at the beginning of this program, just in passing. Now, most of my life, 100 Japanese yen and a dollar have been mostly synonymous. You know, that it's varied between 120 and 80. Well, recently the yen has been down. And recently the yen has been very down, to the point of 155 Japanese yen to the US dollar. And that's not good news, folks. The economy of Japan, of course, has a number of problems. They've got all kinds of structural problems. But 155 yen to the dollar basically means that there's a lot of things in Japan right now. It's a great time to be a tourist in Japan because the higher-end restaurants are relatively cheap and the Japanese themselves can't afford to eat there. And so they're also relatively not crowded. And yeah, that was an item in the Wall Street Journal, and it got me to thinking. Now again, Japan has lots of economic problems, lots of structural economic problems, and I'm not going to even pretend to try to solve all of them in the 8 minutes we have remaining in this show. Even in a full 30-minute show, I wouldn't try it, right? But here's a thought. You know, part of the reason for the depressed value of the yen in foreign markets is, obviously, yen flowing out versus yen flowing in. You know, the Swiss franc went up from like 50 to 80 cents to a euro in 2008 because people were moving into Swiss francs as a safe position. Of course, Switzerland is a small country. They had to do some serious financial management to stop the franc from going higher, which would have been a real problem for them economically. Switzerland is a small country, small pot of money, small pot of people, really. And you drive the value of their currency up. Now, sure, they can buy things more easily from the countries around them, but their whole situation gets messed up, right? Okay. So Japan is clearly spending abroad more than it should be, right? That's driving down the value of the yen in foreign markets. Now, this isn't a new problem. It's been a problem ever since Japan opened to the world, certainly. You know, you look at the history of the yen since the Meiji Restoration, and it's a whole series of currency crises. It's not new. But what are they spending that money on, right? What are they buying in foreign markets? Because, of course, Japan has always bought raw materials in foreign markets to manufacture into goods and then to sell the finished goods abroad again. That's their whole, you know, that's the way their whole economy works, right? That's the foundation of it. Well, one of the major things that they're buying in foreign markets is fuel. Coal, oil, and gas. Now, of course, a major part of that has been the post-Fukushima retreat from nuclear power. Now, they're retreating from that retreat. They're reactivating nuclear power plants. But still, they never got to 50% nuclear power in Japan. And they're struggling to get to, you know, 20. Now, if I were in charge in Japan, I would definitely want to stop the imports of coal and gas or reduce them to a minimum, by building a lot more nuclear power plants, and probably not the light water reactors, right? probably heavy water reactors, probably fast breeder reactors. I'd finished their reprocessing plant at Rokushomura. Right. They had some experience with a prototype fast breeder reactor called Monju. Had a bunch of problems. There was a piping system leak that resulted in a sodium fire. That sounds nasty. It was a tiny little leak of sodium metal from the system. It sprayed out into the air in a sealed room, and the sodium, the product of combustion of a sodium fire is solid, sodium oxide, very, very fine particulate matter, basically produces a dense white smoke until it consumes all of the oxygen in the sealed room. Right. It was basically a penetration into a piping line for a gauge. Vibrated until it sprang a leak. It was really a small problem, but it had the reactor shut down for more than 10 years because of paranoia and anxiety. And then when they went to restart the reactor, they managed to damage the fueling machine. So Monju is just out of the picture. But, you know, they could do sodium fast breeders. They could do heavy water reactors, which I've suggested locating near cities in order to provide heat and cooling. All right, that's fine, right. But a big chunk of the fuel they import is for transportation. And a lot of that transportation is goods. Japan has an extensive railway network which almost exclusively carries passengers. 55% of ton kilometers in Japan of goods are carried by road. In other words, by trucks and vans and cars. 40% is carried by coastwise shipping. And only about 5% by rail freight. The proportions were pretty much the same in 1999. You got to go all the way back to 1970 before road traffic is less than 40%. At that point, it was like 39% road, 18% rail, and 43% shipping. Actual volumes of rail freight have decreased. Well, the thing is that they've been shutting down branch lines to distant remote areas, rural communities, because of lack of passenger traffic. And of course, that not only means more car trips, and it also means that living in those remote areas becomes that much less attractive, which is a serious problem they have, right? People are leaving those areas to go to the cities. The more people leave, the less reason there is to stay, etc. And particularly with an aging population that you don't want old people driving all the time, right? Particularly with the aging population, having that greater accessibility of rail service to outlying areas would be a very good thing. So how do we restore it? And my answer is, I think, that you can save a whole bunch of fuel, particularly because most of these rail lines are electrified. You save a whole bunch of fuel by moving a lot of goods delivery onto rail, the nearly last mile delivery. In other words, set up freight houses, right? If somebody needs a tractor, bring the tractor to him on a flat car. Send a, you know, they've got little bitty shipping containers, right? The smallest ISO shipping containers, you can put more than one onto a train car, right? So you can imagine something almost like a trolley car, which is towing a flat car or one freight car or something, bringing these goods. And where do they bring them to? Well, one of the things about Japan is a lot of people order things cash on delivery. But you're not always home at the time when the deliveryman comes. So there's every convenience store, the Lawson's, the Family Mart's, the 7-Elevens, the convenience store chains, have a thing where you can pay for your COD package in advance at the register at the convenience store, and the convenience store will take delivery of it and hold it for you so you can later pick it up there. So what I'm imagining is we give the Lawson's or the Family Mart or the 7-Eleven in each of these rural communities, right, we give them the franchise, as it were, for the freight handling. We bring the container to their doorstep and let the people there unload it. And, of course, that creates a little more employment because at that point the Lawson's might require two clerks. Anyway, I don't know if that's a solution to Japan's problems, but I think it's a perspective that might help. Anyway, if you like these broadcasts and would like to support them, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam, but I mostly look forward to receiving your cards and letters. Write to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America.